Yeah, I was saying that it was a question of finding a level at which the institutional clients would buy stock again. And at some stage, usually coinciding with the new issue of a tranche of stock or a new stock entirely, it would be the price would be, or the level of yields would rise. I suppose more often than not, it would be a tap stock which had been on tap or available for the public to buy through the market, and the government broker would cut the price of the tap stock. And at that stage, more often than not, the whole of the stock would be taken, usually by the market, very often, and they would then pass it on to jobbers. It became, you had to keep quite a close eye on the situation as to when it was likely that the government broker was going to cut the price of the tap stock, and have orders for your clients ready so that they could deal, because it very often signaled a rise in prices, at least for a short time.
Do you recall what dealing conditions were like during these so-called gilt strikes? Were they ones of poor turnover, or were jobbers constantly depressing prices to find a level at which buyers would come in?
Yes, I think that there was a sort of understanding between the authorities and the jobbers that the prices had to come down in order to sell stuff. It was just a question of getting the right psychological moment, because it was no good the Bank of England and the government broker cutting the price of the tap if, having cut it, they didn't achieve their object, and that is to sell stock. So there had to be almost certain demand there. But that was achieved by the jobbers on occasions building up a bear position. Because it didn't necessarily have to be in the stock that the government were trying to sell. The jobbers could have been overall bears, and then through the switching mechanism they would resolve the cross positions.
How much influence did the jobbers have on prices? Did they simply reflect supply and demand? So if demand was poor, you could guarantee that the prices would be depressed, or could the jobbers actually?
Oh, the jobbers influence? Very often, and there were certain jobbers who didn't like the market standing still, and well, that's understandable, but on occasions would mark prices up when really there wasn't much justification for it, or mark them down because there wasn't much justification for it. But unless somebody had the firepower in the form of orders to stop them doing it, there wasn't much anybody could do.
Do you recall any particular occasions or any particular jobbers who liked to do that?
Yes. Mr. Jimmy Priestley, I think, was much happier when the market was going up than down, whereas other jobbers, I think, were more natural bears and were happier when it was going down. But I always felt that he was happier when he was putting prices up, which, of course, over the years wasn't the way that the market was going, but he was nonetheless a very successful jobber.
In the later 70s, Pinch and Denny opened up a
kitchen. Yes.
Gilts. Did they impinge on the market? Was it something that was welcomed?
Yes. Again, I think that they were encouraged to come into the market by the Bank of England and government broker. At times, they did fulfill a useful role. I don't think they ever got anywhere near approaching the size of business that Wedden Ackroyd had. And in fact, I think in the short market they did quite a reasonable turnover, but not a great deal in the long.
Was it difficult by that stage for another jobber to come in the sense that
it was always a difficult job for any jobber to come into the market? I think one of the most remarkable things was that in the Gilt Edge market was the stability in the size, relative size of firms. The pecking order didn't change a great deal, either in the jobbers or the brokers. Mm-hmm. Various firms of brokers tried at various stages to get into the Gilt Edge market, and one or two achieved some success, but by and large, the firms that had always been there continue to be there.
Mm. Why was that?
I don't know. I think the client relationships obviously were part. The fact that the clients knew that you were an established broker in the Gilt Edge market. I don't think there were many people who wanted to be a Gilt Edge jobber from scratch. And, I mean, Pynchon and Smith came in, I think, more because they were asked to, rather than perhaps they felt that there was any great reward to be achieved by it. The brokers, it was a small market in terms of numbers operating in it, but it was very difficult to achieve business from scratch. Mm.
Does the Battle of Watling Street mean anything in your recollection? It's something people have mentioned to me at various times.
Yes, it was, I think, related to an issue of 0307's another tranche, and one or two firms failed to get their applications for stock in, as I recollected, and because of this, it was very expensive for one or two firms, because their clients didn't receive the stock that they should have done. I think that the broking houses involved had to compensate their clients to some extent. It wasn't a factor that affected us, so I don't...
Can you remember roughly when that was? Sometime in the late 70s?
I guess it would be early 80s. Mm. Late 70s, early 80s. My memory for dates is not the greatest.
Mm. Well, let me ask you now about some of the dealers that you may have had experience of. Was Norman Smithers still in the market when
yes.
you started?
Yes, Uncle Norman. Yes, but he was an elderly gentleman at the stage that I knew him and wasn't taking an active part in the day-to-day business.
So was this a point at which Hugh Merriman and Brian Pepiat were the
yes.
main dealers? How would you describe them as dealers?
Hugh Merriman was a very quiet, aloof, rather withdrawn gentleman who was very shrewd, always, as I say, a little withdrawn, but nevertheless very good and shrewd jobber. And he recruited or had on the pitch two younger chaps, Brian Pepiat and Tim Nixon, who, shall we say, did the day-to-day business for many years, and Brian Pepiat was became, you know, one of the best and shrewdest jobbers that there was in the market.
Could you define what those qualities were, or is it very difficult to define?
Nerve, I suppose, is in the end what describes a good jobber. Never panicking out of a situation. As I've said, all the Gilt Edge stocks were tended to be the same or different. And because you were short of one and long of another, it didn't really matter because in the end you could resolve that situation. The fact that he was prepared to hold a position until it resolved itself naturally. And I always thought of Aykroyd, their motto might have been never knowingly overbought, because the gilt-edged market over the years continued to go down. Mm. It obviously always paid to be a bear of the gilt-edged market, and if you consistently ran a bear book, over the years you'd make money. So I always thought of them as being short of stock. Mm. The government paid you to be, or the market paid you to be short. You got paid as a jobber if you were short of stock. If you were carrying stock, if you were bull of stock, it cost you money. So it was a natural position to be a bear.
Now, did Wedd have a different character to Aykroyd?
Yes. Wedd naturally liked to square the book up. I think that they were less inclined to run big positions for any great length of time. And if they got a large position in the stock, they would rather got it down to more manageable proportions. And this, on occasions, worked to the advantage of my own firm, because we would assist them to find that stock or why not.
You've already described Jimmy Priestley. Mm. Was Dick Wilkins a different job?
Dick Wilkins liked to do the big deal. He didn't like getting involved in the intricacies of switching to any extent. He liked to do the big straight deal, and that was his forte. And he, in a sense, he was a very extrovert character, and I think was thought of as the king of the gilt-edged market for many years, and knew everybody who operated in the market well, and they used to go and chat to him. And but I think he used to just like to do the big deal. He could be extraordinarily harsh with senior people in the market and senior partners of firms, and yet was the kindest and most respectful to the juniors.
Mm.
A remarkable character.
Now, is there anyone I haven't mentioned who comes to mind of the gilt jobbers, perhaps during the 70s?
Well, I think that a person who may not have been mentioned to any great extent was Herbert Wilson of Wilson & Watford. Wilson & Watford was formed after the Second World War by Herbert Wilson and Vivian Watford, and became really number three, I think, in many ways. They certainly did more bargains than any other firm in the gilt-edged market, or any jobbing firm in the gilt-edged market. And I think at many times people would have been surprised at the amount of business that they did. They tended to contract in the later years, after the retirement of Herbert Wilson, and in the period before Big Bang had contracted to some extent. But in the 70s, they were quite a force in the market.
Mm. As we get towards the end of the 70s, there was the Stock Exchange rule book was taken up by the Restrictive Practices Court. On the floor of the House, did you feel there was any strain on the way the Stock Exchange was set up as a market? Did you feel any strain on the single capacity system?
Yes, I think that although brokers probably didn't acknowledge the fact, those that had a substantial gilt-edged business, undoubtedly it was a very rewarding business. I think the short-dated stocks, the commission was at discretion. Therefore, you could do bargains for nothing. If a client dealt with us in the long-dated stocks, we would never charge him commission on shorts, for instance. But because the level of commissions was laid down by the council, we were bound to charge those commissions, and it was a very good position to be in. They were reduced in the period leading up to Big Bang, and there was quite a feeling that perhaps they, by some brokers, that they shouldn't have been reduced. But compared with the profitability that has ensued since the level of profitability in the gilt edge market by the larger firms was usually quite good.
Did broking firms ever feel they wanted to job stocks themselves? Did they ever resent the fact that things had to be put through the market?
Oh yes, yes. I'm sure that there were occasions when, and this is where the net bargains came into effect, that it was an effort to bypass the market and to avoid having to pay the jobber's turn, that net bargains were done. I know my own firm, I mean, we could happily have run a jobbing book in a sense, which would have expedited our business.
Conversely, did you ever suspect the jobbers of having contact with the clients?
Not to any great extent, no. I know that there were some clients who did speak to jobbers direct on occasions, they were few in number, and I don't think they were a major factor.
Did the discount houses ever provide much of a competition?
Yes, the discount houses would have at times liked to have been the market in short-dated gilt-edge stocks. But when it came down to it, they didn't have the source of outlets, or they didn't have the range of outlets that are the larger brokers had, and so they weren't able ever to achieve what they might have liked to have done in that area. But they were big operators, some of them at times, and did carry large inventories of short-dated stocks and longs on occasions, but not always with happier results.
Just a couple of concluding questions. What would you have said were the strengths of the single capacity system if, for example, someone from the New York Stock Exchange or the Paris Bourse asked you why you had this strange system of jobbers and brokers?
Well, the New York Stock Exchange is a single capacity system. They have specialists.
Yes.
Not in their bond market. I mean, they have a different system there. But the greatest single thing to be said for the single capacity market was that you employed the broker as your agent. And if you knew your broker, you could rely on him for impartial advice. And I think this was the greatest single thing in favor of single capacity. You paid a commission, you knew what the commission was, and for that commission you got impartial advice. And you could, if you didn't like your broker, you could go to another broker and pay him the same commission. But in a dual capacity situation, which you have now, the advice you're getting from your financial advisor, be he an integrated house, may be less than impartial if he is a seller of that stock or if he is a buyer of a stock. He may be inviting you to buy a stock that he has got on his book and which he is, the chap is talking to you has been told to sell for all his worth. And that is not impartial advice. I'm not saying that that happens to a great extent, but it is a risk. I think there was a lot to be said for the stability of the market in a single capacity situation. There was, in many ways, less scope for manipulation, and I think it, in many ways it was difficult to justify I regret its going in many ways. I don't know that we have a better system now.
Would you say it had any weaknesses?
It had weaknesses in that its cost structure was too high. Mm. You had two people to reward, in the sense that you had the broker and the jobber both to obtain a living out of dealing in it. But I think that in the gilt-edge market, because of the level of turnover, that reward in as a percentage of the turnover was very small. And so, in fact, it was the government got a very good service cheaply, in fact. Mm. The people who, the brokers and the jobbers, I think, got rewarded well. But I think in many ways they worked quite hard for it. And I think that it achieved for the government quite cheaply what they'd sought to achieve.
As a final question, how would you contrast the stock exchange as a trading floor towards the end of the single capacity system with the trading floor that you'd known as a young dealer
it
in
was
the early 1960s?
Not as good. It was more clinical. It lacked atmosphere. I think the character of the old market was never achieved by the new stock exchange floor. There were people who had character, it lacked some indefinable something.
Had the way people dealt changed in any way?
I don't think it got any better. I think that with the passing of some of the older generation, the discipline in some ways became less. It didn't hold the attraction for me after about 1980, and that is when I, in fact, stopped dealing on the floor. I think it is a young man's, it became a young man's business. And I was at that stage getting a bit long in the tooth.
I think we'll finish there. Thank you very much.